Hello and welcome back to Humans of Speedway, a very special episode as we look back on the best of the guests for 2020. What a year it's been on many levels, but it's been great to bring this podcast to you and hopefully fill the void of Speedway action just a little bit in your minds and in your ears. And thanks to everybody who's listened so far and downloaded any of the episodes. Now, if you haven't listened to all of them yet, well, you're going to get a flavour of all the different episodes that Humans of Speedway has done through the course of 2020. Hearing from the likes of Nigel Pearson, Neil Machin, Peter Oakes, Shane Parker, Phil Morris, and Gary Havelock and Kelvin Tatum. In fact, there's a flavour of all of the different episodes we've done, and we're up to episode 14 so far, so quite a lot to cram in over the next hour and a bit. So strap yourself in and enjoy. Right now, we're going to kick off where it all began back in May this year, released the first episode of Humans of Speedway. But guest number one was a rider who was not riding this year because of the way 2020 has gone, but he's done plenty of it in the past, seven-time British champion Scott Nichols. It was brilliant to have Scott as episode one, because he's just done and won everything there is to win and do in Speedway. And the bit I'm going to play you is where we're talking about the British Grand Prix. It's obviously, we know, a massive event on the Speedway calendar, on the World Speedway calendar. All eyes are on you. And if you're a Brit riding in that stadium with the roof closed and a huge racket, you know that you've got a lot of support and a lot of eyes on you. But does that support necessarily translate into making it easier for you to do your job and get out there and ride? And what with everything else that goes on for a Speedway rider, here's Scott Nichols explaining why riding at Cardiff in particular, it's not as easy as it looks.
Mentally, it would just be really tough. You know, I found it hard. I mean, it would be, you've got the pressures of trying to perform to your best against the best in the world, which is enough pressure on that in itself. And then you walk out of that tunnel to the track and you look up and you just see this sea of flags of Union Jacks and St George's Crosses and Welsh Dragons, and you're just like, oh my god, like I've never seen this many people at a Speedway event before in my life, and the noise is just phenomenal, and then you know that there's TV cameras there and there's all these people watching from around the world, and there's no hiding. Every you ride like a plonker and it sticks out like a sore thumb, you know you're going to get your rear end well and truly kicked. So there's a massive amount of pressure. So mentally, probably more than anything, you're going in there just going, oh my god. And I did struggle with that for some time in the Grand Prix as a whole. And it wasn't, you know, and I probably kind of learned a bit about the psychology side of things and how to deal with that probably a bit late on. And that was something I struggled with. I think it's that's a huge part of it, you know. It's easy to say it's just any other race, but it's not. It's totally not. And so yeah, for in that respect, Cardiff is something that is very enjoyable, but is the pressures and the nerves associated with it early doors were not really that enjoyable in some respects.
What was the thing that played on your mind the most? Was it the fact that there were so many people watching, or was it the level of the competition that you were at? What was your sort of inner fear, really?
It's probably the amount of people there and the knowing that all the eyes are on you as well. The other thing as well, especially at Cardiff, is that every rider gets a brilliant reception there, which I think is great. You know, I think that's what's so cool about Speedway as a whole, is it's a very family oriented sport. But, you know, even when you do the track walk before the meeting starts, you know, and the stadium is not nowhere near full at that point because you're doing your track walk probably an hour or so before the actual meeting's going to start. And it's, as you're walking around, the air horns are following you as you're walking around the track. And it wasn't until I kind of learned the ability and the kind of the mindset of flipping that to your advantage and kind of using that as a kind of a support mechanism as opposed to a crippler, you know. Initially, it was early, do you like, oh my god, all these people want you to do so well, and you know it's lovely, but you're just like, oh my god, I'm letting all, if I ride like an absolute plonker, I'm letting all these people down, and then there's all the people on TV, and so as much as you know that you're up against these amazingly talented riders, who you were worried about trying to beat. I think it was the fact that there's so many people there watching you, wanting you to do well, that you felt really bad if you let them down, as much as you, first and foremost, you don't want to disappoint yourself. But it was, so there is massive pressure, and you can understand why riders sometimes underperform in situations like that, or touch your tapes and get nervous, because there's the pressure to win, but it's also the pressures that they're feeling from the people that want them to do well. And although everybody there wants people to do well and is willing them on, it can actually have the adverse effect on some people if they can't flick that switch in their mind to use it to their advantage.
And such fine margins on the day as well. You know, you could move an inch and it could be all over for you.
It is massively game over. And also at places like Cardiff, because they're one-off events, the ruts at the start line get really, really deep. So because we have to be within a certain kind of margin away from the tapes, you roll your bike back, but because if you can imagine, your back wheel is on a rut, so the bike is always trying to push forward anyway, and we don't have brakes, so you're trying to hold the bike back. So the moment you kind of, you know, dip your clutch or slightly let the weight off the bike to try and anticipate any movement, the bike is naturally going to push forward even more than if you're on a flat surface. So all those things get accentuated and become more critical, and obviously in the Grand Prix the refs are very vigilant, and so you've got the start line is a huge amount of pressure.
From episode one, that was Scott Nichols talking about the pressures of riding in front of such a huge crowd in Cardiff. Now, in episode two, I spoke to one half of Speedway's notorious double act, Tatum and Pearson. Going to speak to the other half before the end of this podcast. First, though, it was Nigel Pearson in episode two, and we talked, obviously, Speedway. We talked a bit about the likelihood of Bradford coming back, and we've obviously heard a bit more about that now. And we spoke a little bit about darts, but I asked Nigel how he got started in commentary in the first place. It's a very specific kind of job, being a sports reporter, and a very difficult job to make it big in as well. And obviously, that journey had to begin somewhere. So how did Nigel's journey to being the voice of Speedway begin?
Back in 1989, I just started my first full-time job as a writer with a newspaper in the West Midlands, County Express Group, which covered Halesowen, Stourbridge and Dudley. And I started as a trainee sports writer. And within 6 months, they'd promoted me to sports editor. But at the same time, I was doing hospital radio, and I was going to West Bromwich Albion games and covering it for DDHB, Dudley and District Hospital Broadcasting. And at the same time, I sent demo cassettes off, you know, the TDKC 90 and all that. And I sent demo cassettes off to BBC WM, Beacon Radio and BR&B. I think I did two games for WM when they were short, and they gave me an opportunity, which was fantastic. But then George Gavin at BR&B gave me a call and said, how do you fancy Halesowen Town versus Tranmere in the FA Cup on a phone line? So George booked me a phone line at Halesowen, November 89, FA Cup. Still got the programme now. And I did, I think, 8 updates into Saturday Sport with George on BR&B. And then I did every weekend from there on. He just put me as part of the team. And I think within 3 weeks or thereabouts, I'd have to Google fixtures that year. But certainly on or around November or December 89, it gave me Manchester United versus Aston Villa at Old Trafford.
Oh, hello.
And I just could not believe it. He rang me, because there's no email then, no text messaging. Hi, Nigel, it's George. Fancy Old Trafford Saturday? Do I? What? Do I? So George gave me that opportunity, and I'd started doing football every weekend, midweek as well, and I remember going to Scarborough versus Walsall on a Tuesday night. Did the rounds, went to all the lower league grounds covering Walsall. That was on BR&B. So that was how the broadcasting started. And then in 96, a guy called Colin Wilshire approached me for Beacon. They were going to revamp their sports coverage and actually start taking it seriously and do contracts with Wolves and West Brom to do commentary deals, which didn't necessarily go down too well with Tom at BR&B, Tom Ross at BR&B at the time, because not only was I moving away, but, you know, we were effectively in opposition, even though we were commercial radio together. Obviously, yeah. We're trying to build listeners up in Wolverhampton and Shropshire. And Tom and BR&B had exclusivity with Birmingham, Villa. You know, so it that's how it moved on to Beacon. So I presented the sports show, I commentated on the sports show, and I did Monday to Friday breakfast sports bulletins from 6 a.m. until 10 a.m.
Wow.
So it was busy, but it was fun. And also after that, then Beacon, I'd just taken out a mortgage. And then Beacon decided to drop sport and get rid of me.
That's commercial radio for you.
There you go, Ian. There you go. I knew that would resonate somewhere. Then Talk Sport was just being launched. I started doing games when it was called Talk Radio back in the day. And then in 2000, they launched Talk Sport. And I asked one of the producers at Talk Sport, what does that mean then? He said, more work for you. So then that kicked on, and I'm still with Talk Sport to this day, 20 years later. And I look back on my time with Talk Sport with great pride, because I've presented, I've commentated, I've read sports bulletins, I've done Formula One coverage. I was the first commentator, the first lead commentator on Talk Sport when they won national commentary, when they won a national commentary contract. Myself and Alvin Martin did a year, and then myself and Stan Collymore.
Wow.
But then the TV had started kicking in, Ian, because I'd started doing Sky Sports Speedway. I was given meetings there. And then the boss of the Sky Sports Speedway team also was the boss of the Sky Sports Darts team. And he knew I'd been a fan of darts, because every time we poked up at a meeting, I'd talk about it. Great Premier League the other night. You know, match play was good. I watched that. That was brilliant. And then one day, we were in a pub somewhere in London, and he just pulled me to one side. Right, Nigel, there's more darts coming in on Sky. Do you fancy a dabble? And then in 2006, I went and did my first darts commentary at the Circus Tavern in Purfleet, in the last World Championship to be held at the Circus Tavern. And I was probably more nervous than I ever have been for anything in my life. And I started then, and I'm still with the Sky Sports Darts team to this day, with a wonderful team of people, and probably do 25 to 30 days of darts per year on the Sky Sports team. Great to be part of that team. So that's, in a nutshell, my broadcast career, how it evolved and where it's at now.
It's Nigel Pearson from episode 2, and speaking to the other part of that double act, Kelvin Tatum, before the end of this Best of the Guests for 2020. Episode 3, I spoke to Speedway author Jeff Scott, who about 15 years ago set himself the challenge of visiting every single Speedway track in the UK through one season, and chronicling this in a book called Showered in Shale. Since then, he's made a similar journey across Europe, following the Speedway Grand Prix series and all the weird and wonderful locations that those events happen at. And here is Jeff talking us through some of the weird and wonderful quirks of Speedway in the far reaches of Europe.
I've been to two whole series worth of the Speedway Grand Prix. So I've been to all the tracks they have, and that often appears to be something like a sort of Duke of Edinburgh award scheme, where they test your compass skills and your ability to get to remote locations in the middle of nowhere in various sort of obscure European, newly European countries. But looking at Sweden, I think, again, I don't want to culturally stereotype, but there is a sort of more community nature, or, you know, people don't really try and stand out as the big I am in Sweden, I don't think, or Denmark. There's a very much... everybody's roughly at the same sort of level. So a typical, as judged by the Speedway Grand Prix tracks, and I'd love to go around to all the tracks in Sweden, they tend to be in a forest. They tend to be built with rain in mind, because I don't think they're short of rain over there. And yeah, it has sort of more modest benching. I think it has a different range of shots. Last year when I was in Melilla, they confiscated my water as I went in, and I said, well, what shall I do for a drink? And the security man said, the water is so pure here you can drink from the toilet. And while that didn't seem quite what I had in mind, it was a good suggestion. I think the biggest innovation I saw food-wise in Sweden was, again, at Melilla, where they have they're selling the chips and the burgers, and then they have these, they were almost right in Speedway colour terms, they have like four udders hanging down. So in one, you've got tomato ketchup, the red one, you've got a white one for mayonnaise, and you've got the yellow one for mustard. And quite what, if they'd had an extra blue one, that would have just been perfect. But again, I don't suppose blue cheese dressing or whatever, that would have to be in that. I don't know if it'd be that popular. I can't imagine there's many Speedway fans that like blue cheese, really. That's just a guess. Looking, say, at Poland, I mean, everyone talks about how wonderful, you know, Poland is a league on, you know, that everyone's attracted to, the riders, from a finance and sponsorship point of view, but also from a crowd point of view. And I mean, all Polish football clubs, speedway clubs, given the nature of sort of Eastern Europe and sort of Iron Curtain countries, Soviet bloc countries, there was a lot of sort of community pride in your club. So if you were the state or the local council would invest in their speedway stadia and give it to their football club or rent it out at bargain rates to people. So I think we talk about why don't we emulate what's happening in Poland, but we sort of misunderstand the sort of ownership basis of the stadiums, because in the UK, we've always been sort of adventitiously involved with Greyhound tracks, rugby league tracks, and so on. The Reading club historian, Arnie Gibbons, has got a very good theory about looking at the rise Greyhounds arriving in the country in 1962 is one of the big drivers of new speedway tracks, because you can't run Greyhounds every night. So you need events to subcontract to use to maximize the use of the stadium. But coming back to more to your question, yeah, I mean, I think there's a certain shared language, language and vernacular of speedway, irrespective of the language that's spoken. I do think, at a club level, I'm not so sure, at sort of more a glamorous big international event level, because that attracts a different type of audience, although still an older audience. I think at a club level, there is very much, yeah, there doesn't seem to be too much difference. When I went to Germany, where I went to a couple of locations there, there seems to be a real thing of bringing your own swimming float along. And you think, well, that's a weird thing. But it turns out, but they don't really have much seating. They tend to have sort of more rough-hewn stepped terraces. So anyone in their right mind is going to bring their own swimming float, or a deluxe version with sort of handles on the side. Garden furniture, you can't really go wrong with that anywhere. If you go to Halstavik in Sweden, it seems to be set in some sort of, I don't know, maybe a Game of Thrones. They could stage that there. It's a very rocky, outcroppy sort of place, where again, comfortable things to sit on is really the way to go.
Jeff Scott from episode 3 explaining the need to take something comfortable to sit on if you're heading to mainland Europe to watch your speedway. 2020's Best of the Guests on Humans of Speedway, and episode 4, we spoke to one of Britain's most prolific speedway promoters. He's been involved in running speedway clubs for almost 30 years and mainly synonymous being the driving force behind Sheffield right from the early 90s to, well, about 10 years or so ago, wasn't it now? And more recently at Leicester as well. It was a very interesting chat, this, talking about not only running speedway clubs, but also his relationship with Rob Wolfenden. Neil Machin used to be Rob Wolfenden's mechanic, and obviously is now the godparent of Britain's most successful ever speedway rider, Ty Wolfenden. All that is covered in episode 4. But we're turning our attention to when Neil Machin took over at Sheffield, and how really it took over with not a lot, including not particularly very many riders. As you'll hear, that can be a bit of a problem, and certainly it's a bit of a problem when you sign riders and they kind of go a bit AWOL. Here is Neil Machin from episode 4.
Well, I'd have to say that going back to 94 was an absolute commercial disaster. We were still as green as grass. We hadn't got anywhere near break even. We invested in the biggest signing that Sheffield could have made it at that time, a character by the name of Sean Moran. Sean, to describe him by his situation as Tim Looking did, Sean with only a handful of meetings into the season, had a crisis of confidence. I don't believe he's ever thrown his leg over a speedway bike since. A major setback, record signing, an enormous financial commitment. Sean did a few meetings at home, retired. We had no number one, and we still owed, I don't know, £10,000 or £12,000 on his transfer fee at the time. So 94 was a struggle. The same year, I transferred Rodney Calhoun from Peterborough. He did the season, halved his average, and never came back. So that wasn't exactly the best investment we ever made.
It's not stacking up. It's a very good season at all, this, is it, Leo?
94 was a... I'll tell you what, if you could get over 94, you could live with just about anything. We had stacks, lots of rain-offs. We had to restructure the team. The brightest thing about 94 was bringing Greg Bartlett from West Australia. He was such a prolific novice, and I have to describe him that way because I'd actually witnessed him in West Australia, done about three or four meetings at Claremont, and we threw him straight into the league program here in the UK. So he was the bright part of 94, and we had stacks of rain off. And actually, something that people will find probably unbelievable in this era, we had eight outstanding fixtures to stage at home in October. And we were running Thursdays and Sundays and Thursdays and Mondays and Thursdays and Sundays right through the month, never had a rain off. Got through the whole thing and actually finished the last day of October on a Monday night with a Northern Riders Championship. I must have had some energy in those days. and of course, Tim as well. You know, we must have had some energy in those days.
Two or three times a week, eh?
Well, at least twice at home during the month of October. And of course, we also had a smattering of away commitments to undertake as well. So, 94, commercially, an absolute write-off. We'd spent the money. We had no Sean Moran. We had no Rodney Calhoun. But the brightest thing about it, of course, is that we did have, I brought in three riders that year. Greg Bartlett to start the season. Robbie Kesler came in later, who turned out to be an absolute gentleman to deal with and a prolific figure around Sheffield for many years to come. George Stansel came into the equation.
Of course, yeah.
It was sort of a couple of steps forward and three going backwards in a way, because obviously we didn't need to sign Rodney and Sean and lose them within the first season, shall we say. The investment in the other three, Stansel, Robbie Kesler, and Greg Bartlett, should have been the icing on the cake. They actually became the cake. So, 94, it was very testing times. I think we probably just about got out of jail at the end of 94, but we had enormous financial losses because of the money that we owed, that was still remaining on bad transfers that we'd entered the market with.
That's Neil Machin talking about life at Sheffield in the early days. And you can hear more about what it's like to run a club from Neil Machin in episode 4. Episode 5, caught up with somebody that's been described to me as one of the most influential men in British Speedway. And that is Peter Oakes. Now, Peter Oakes is a reporter, a journalist, and has worked for some serious Fleet Street newspapers, but also with an interest in Speedway, became one of the most prolific Speedway reporters as well, writing for the Speedway Star ever since the late 50s and early 60s, and still is writing for them today. He's also done every job I think there is to do apart from being a rider. He's worked in PR, he's been a promoter, a team manager, and the personal manager of perhaps the greatest ever rider, Ivan Major. But how did that friendship come about?
'63, I first met Ivan. Neither of us can actually remember the circumstances, but all I can remember was that his wife, Ray, I was living in Burton, the whole site in Diggs at the time, and I can remember Ray saying to me, look, you must come and have Sunday lunch with us. You know, there I was, an 18-year-old, living away from home, and you know, not, you know what you sort of like at that age. You don't exactly have the best things to eat, and you don't have your Sunday lunch or no matter. But Ray asked me to go for Sunday lunch. I'll never forget it because Sunday lunch was a curry.
of course.
But you know, they lived then at Upper Chalton Road, which is in a, or was in a very poor district of Manchester, in Moss Side. And these are all the houses that were owned by Mike Parker, who was, if the truth be known, a bit of a rackman, that he, you know, he bought all old houses. He didn't do them up. He just basically, you know, rented them out. But he also provided these houses for all his riders. He had a lot of Australian and New Zealand riders who would come over, and they would all literally live next door to each other in this little enclave in Upper Chalton Road. All sorts of names. They say Goog Allen lived there, Graham Coombs lived there, Bruce Ovenden lived there, Gary Peterson, the late Gary Peterson, who was killed at Wolverhampton, he lived there. Murray Bird, who was another New Zealander. Jim Airy, obviously the great Australian. Gordon Guasco, there's another Australian. You know, every rider that Parker brought in to Britain lived there. Toby Harrison, Swedish rider, lived there. And that was where Ollie Olsen first lived when he first came over to ride for Newcastle.
Wow, what a street.
Well, it wasn't even a street. It was three houses, literally.
Blimey.
I would go to the houses. And obviously, I would then spend all my spare time chatting to all these riders. And, you know, getting the stories and features about them. If I look back at sort of 63, 64, the Speedway Star would have a feature almost every week that I'd written, which was nearly always about one of these riders who were living in these houses, because you could go and see them.
I bet you wish it was still like that in some ways. It's so easy to just go and track them down, whereas now they're jetting here and there and everywhere. It's completely different days.
Yeah, the only thing that today has, at least there's mobile phones.
Yes.
that if you bear in mind, like in the 60s, there were no such things as mobile phones. And very few of the riders, or certainly not the riders who came over from Australia and New Zealand, because they were always living on virtually nothing. You know, they didn't even have landlines, so you couldn't phone them. But I had this great advantage of actually seeing them all on a regular basis. And you know, some really nice stories from those days. I can remember Jim Airy and Gordon Guasco, who were really great mates and travelled everywhere together. You know, just being like sort of school kids when it snowed on what must have been a March, or you know, possibly even as late as April. And they literally had never seen snow in their lives. And you can imagine that they suddenly see this snow. They'd obviously heard about it, but never seen it. And they really were like a couple of, you know, 8 or 9 year olds wanting to go and throw snowballs at each
Fantastic.
Other. Fantastic. a lot of fun. And, you know, Ivan or Ray was the matriarch of them all, that Ray looked after all of them. And they obviously all, you know, went to Ivan for their advice. They all shared workshops. And then the other great thing that sort of, you know, taught me, that like, really, you wouldn't take a dog into these houses, the estates. I'm not saying that they weren't dirty, because they were looked after by the people in there, but they were really run down houses. And you look there and you see the actual background of the riders who went on to be very famous riders, in particular. You know, Ivan and Ollie both went on to win, you know, world titles, and you can understand how they kept their feet on the ground and how they were so determined and so ambitious and so hardworking, because they literally pulled themselves up from, you know, what were basically in a slum area. Mm-hmm. As I said, the houses weren't, because the houses were, the rooms were beautifully kept and everything, but you know, it's really, I think it is nice to actually look back and see that these people never changed.
Peter Oakes there on the Humans of Speedway podcast from earlier this year. Best of the guests 2020. And, you know, they've all been great episodes in their own different ways. And another of my favourites, personal favourites, was a chat I had with a legend of so many British clubs, including Glasgow and Sheffield and King's Lynn and Ipswich, and known for being an entertainer and a bit of a wind-up merchant on his day as well. But a lot of fondness for this guy across Speedway in Britain. And I hooked up with him at home in Adelaide, Australia, Shane Parker. And we talked about some of the antics he used to get up to as a Speedway rider, both during the meetings and occasionally stripping off as well. One of his party pieces, naked hot laps. Take a listen.
Yeah, being an entertainer, that was any testimonial or benefit meeting or any sort of individuals or special meetings, I would always ask if they wanted naked hot laps, and if they wanted them, well, I would oblige. So I remember years ago seeing a picture of Brego doing it with a sticker stuck on one of his butt cheeks. And back in the day, you probably could get away with being totally naked, just boots and a helmet. But I always used to run me box, so I was covered up and decent for the kids.
Safety first.
Yes, I remember going to Boyce's testimonial, actually, and going around Paul Speedway, and I think I was only like 2 or 3 seconds off the track record or something. It might have not have been that close, but it weren't far off the track record. And Boyce's come up to me, he goes, "You're a bloody idiot, mate. What if you come off?" And I kind of sort of took that on board, but it didn't stop me.
That would be quite incredible to break the track record naked. Would it stand?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I think it'd be pretty limp at the time, to be honest.
Yeah, that needs rephrasing.
Yes.
But the entertainment value is something I see that you were obviously pretty handy with a hose pipe, with centre green announcers and promoters and so on as well.
It's just putting on a show, like I said, banter, and I always had a lot of banter with Kevin Long, who was the announcer at Ipswich for quite a while. Apparently, I came in from a race one day and my mechanic turned around and said to me, he goes, "Jesus, that commentator just ripped into you and give you heaps." And I said, "Did he?" And so I thought, all right, no worries. So I thought I'd grab a bucket of water and stroll out to the infield and tip the bucket of water over him, which I did. I drenched him. And he was standing there with a microphone in his hand. Anyway, I ended up getting pulled into the Ipswich office at the end of the meet. This was after I'd rode for him, mind you. one of the promoters at Ipswich, Mike Weston, was trying to get me banned. He wanted to get me banned because I could have electrocuted Kevin Long with a microphone in his hand. And I turned around and said to Mike, I said, "What, with a 9-volt battery in it, mate?" I said, "You got to be kidding." I guess that was his approach at the time. And I had a bit of a laugh about it and still do, actually. It was quite funny. But no, it's a bit of banter here and there. I actually remember winding a guy up at Newport Speedway. He was hanging over the fence and giving me a sign that I probably can't say. So I went up to him and I started giving him a bit of lip back, and he bent down, and as he's come back up, he's got a big rock in his hand. So I thought, I'm out of here, and I dropped my clutch and took off, and I don't know whether he threw the rock at me, but it was pretty big and in his hand, ready to go.
At least you had the helmet on, or did you not have the helmet on?
No, I had the helmet on, and it was probably a good thing. I try not to wind fans up too much. Probably the worst I've wound somebody up, I might have probably gone a little bit too far with that one.
When you look at over your career and you look back at the stories and things that have happened over the time, what are the stories that sort of make you smile the most, like those?
Oh, geez, that's difficult. I mean, probably the funniest one was another one that involved Ipswich, actually. I was riding for King's Lynn, and Buster Chapman was the team manager and obviously the owner of King's Lynn, and we'd gone back to Ipswich, and obviously haven't ridden for 5 years, you know what they get up to. And I was watching the tractor go round, and every time Ipswich went off 1 and 3, the grader rode over 1 and 3, and every time it went off 2 and 4, they'd roll 2 and 4, pack it down. So I've clocked onto this pretty quick, and trying to sort of tell the referee that what they were doing was wrong, and it sort of didn't succeed. So a race had finished. I moseyed out in the middle and jumped into the tractor and tried to grade the track myself. Bob, the grader driver at the time, grabbed me by the collar and me leathers and tried to drag me out the tractor. And there's a bit of a scuffle went on. And long story short, I ended up getting out. I couldn't get it in gear. I didn't realise there was two levers you had to use. So I went nowhere in the end. And got out the grader, and by this time Buster's come running over and he's trying to stick up for me, and there was a whole heap of people around, and I've just sort of headed off back into the pits, and I've turned around and I've seen a round circle of people, and Buster in the middle and arms flying left, right and centre, and I left Buster to it.
Just wash your hands and run off.
Yeah, I did. But I've actually got a clip out of the newspaper from that. It made the newspaper in Ipswich, so I always gave him something that was good for the local rag.
Ever the entertainer, Shane Parker on Humans of Speedway from earlier this year. I'm Ian Brannan. We're looking back at the best of the guests from 2020. And from one of the stars on the track to a star off the track, which is what the podcast is all about, really, because, yeah, there's the riders, but there's also these key individuals that without them, the sport wouldn't happen. And that's definitely the case when you're talking about referees. And earlier this year, I caught up with one of the men in the box overseeing things, an FIM referee, no less, Chris Durno, and spoke to Chris about what it is like to be a referee, how you go about becoming one in the first place, and the training that's involved. I mean, spoiler alert for you, the training is very thorough and goes on a lot longer than you'd imagine. Check out How to Be a Referee in the full episode. But right now, we're going to have a listen to Chris talking about some of the things that weigh heavily on a referee's mind.
You probably straight away, people might think the biggest decisions that a referee make is during a meeting, whether you've got to exclude rider A or rider B. It's not. The biggest decision that a referee always will make is whether a meeting goes on or not. That is really puts you in a position where you've got a weather affected surface, you know, and it's really is the referee's decision at the end of the day. You've got to fully consider rider safety, but at the same time, if there is any way that a track can be rectified and worked on and improved, you know, you've got to sort of also have consideration for the promotion as well, that, you know, if at all possible, you know, attempts should be made. And that's where you really are caught piggy in the middle, where you may have one team, say a home team, that are keen to ride, and the away team absolutely steadfast against not riding, you know, and then you are caught in the middle of that and have to work your way through it. Talk to the riders as much as possible. Ask them if there's anything that can be done that can improve the situation. You know, do what you can to the track, you know, and see if anything can be done to remedy that, you know, and then hopefully get it to a point where you are satisfied that sufficient work has gone on, that it would be safe to start. But then it is your call then, and then you go back up to that box, and that first race in that sort of situation, your heart's in your mouth, you know, you hope you've got it right and you've not caused any problems or caused any extra safety risk to the riders. But then obviously you start the meeting. So that is always for me is sort of the toughest decision, as against, you know, sort of racing decisions, which you make your best judgment upon.
I suppose with racing decisions, it's a straightforward black or white if it's in the rules or not, isn't it? Whereas if a track's safe to ride, there's maybe a little bit more interpretation of opinion between different people on that one.
Yeah, you're always watching a race. You know, you're almost judging all the time. You're trying to see incidents start to happen before they happen. So if two riders are, you know, in close contact, you're always focused entirely on that, and you're trying to sort of understand, you know, quite often you think something's going to happen, it doesn't happen, but you know, you've got an opinion of where the riders are at that position, who was in the lead, you know, who was challenging, who was in contact with other riders, and then you've just got a level of experience then that you make an understanding, you know, what was the primary reason for the incident that happened, and then make your judgment on that based on that and the rules and the regulations.
What about the difficult moments when it comes to keeping an eye on the racing? I imagine there's some fun moments there as well.
Oh, yeah. It's always quite difficult when you get two races in a single heat. you may have two riders battling out at the front and two at the back, and it's always where you're glancing between the two different racing pairs, and you may be focused on the sort of the leading pair, and something may have happened on sort of the rear pair, and then you've got to try and sort of analyze what you last saw, where they were, and try and understand what you think caused the issue, and sort of make that judgment call.
It was a fascinating episode, the chat with Chris Durno. If you ever wondered about the sort of things that a referee does, and I say how to become a referee as well, all of that demystified in the episode with Chris Durno from earlier this year. Now, somebody who works very closely with referees these days is a former star of Reading and Newport, and now the man who is the ringmaster of the Speedway Grand Prix. The FIM Speedway GP race director, Phil Morris, joined us earlier this year on Humans of Speedway to talk about his career and his role, and of course, specifically, the stuff that he has to look after with the Grand Prix. And I think when you look at slick meetings and presentation of meetings, the Grand Prix series is the benchmark. And so what work goes in to ensure that those meetings run like clockwork? Because you've got to remember, the Speedway Grand Prix, not only a Speedway meeting, but it's a TV show as well, shown right around the world. Here's Phil talking us through some of his duties building up to a GP.
Once a year, I meet with every organiser, clerk of the course, normally in February. We spend a day going through how we expect A to be done, B to be done, X to be done, Y, Z. We want the show to look the same, whether it's in Cardiff or in Timbuktu. Apart from the stadium, we want the show, we want the feel, we know how it's working. I can tell you, we had 10 Grand Prix last year, and apart from one of them, they all finished within 5 minutes of each other, from heat wow. 1 to 23. And that's around about 2 hours, 20 minutes. But going back to what we say, we've got a big, heavy work manual, and all a promoter, whether it's Torin, whether it's Prague, they can go through that book. And as long as they follow that book, it's pretty much laid out in front of them. So for me, British Speedway should be having somebody do a work manual that everyone follows. So it's the same everywhere. Start the same. They do this the same. They do that the same. Four heats grade. The grade should only be 6 minutes long. And all these things, if you put it in place and everyone starts learning from it, but it's very difficult when you've got British Speedway where they'll probably say, well, you shouldn't come and tell us what to do, instead of thinking, let's do it for the benefit of the sport. I'm lucky to be involved in the Grand Prix. I'm very privileged to be involved in it. But I see what goes on behind, lots of things go wrong. The people, as long as people don't see it in the crowd or on the TV, we've done our job. So it's about minimizing the fault and the problems behind the scene, and so not covering them up, making sure they are fixed before it's known to the crowd, in a sense.
Yeah, it's that great sort of live event situation of trying to present a graceful swan on the surface, but you can not see the legs kicking like mad underneath the water.
No, you guys like yourself, you just talk a bit more and they can. But no, it's very difficult to, we do a production meeting at every Grand Prix. And when we're looking at timing, we're not talking hours or minutes, we're talking seconds. So at 7:03 and 30 seconds, this will happen. Because I know at 7:03 and 50 seconds, riders get pushed off. That's my first thing that I work off. So, yeah. And people don't realize that these attention to small details, it's just once you've got it ingrained, it becomes normal. And I can promise you, the riders actually get used to it. We do four races, bang, 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 and we have a 6 or 7 minute gap. So they know, where they've got to be. They know how it works. The riders know what's happening. And once everyone knows what's happening, it becomes normal, and it's not difficult to do. But I just feel a good, solid sort of blueprint that every track does X, Y, Z. It helps because everybody knows when you go to, whether it's Birmingham, whether it's Poole, whether it's Edinburgh, whether it's Berwick, wherever you go, the show will be the same. of course you have different riders. Let's try it. You know, I'm not preaching you because, you know, it's not my job. I'm involved in the Grand Prix. But yeah, you look at Poland, the reality is they followed what the Grand Prix have done. But you look at a lot of the things, they've got a work manual. They do things at this time, at that time. This has to be done then, that has to be done. And it all falls into place and looks a better product, in my opinion.
And really, the whole production needs to be well-timed because you've got TV and TV demand specific timings. You know, TV stations and TV programs run by the second themselves anyway, so they're going to expect a meeting like this to follow the same guidelines.
Yeah, obviously with the TV, you know, we've got a 3-hour start to finish schedule, and I can assure you nobody wants it to go past 3 hours because, you know, some countries are going to lose a feed and things like that. So touch wood, which I'm doing right now, we've not failed with that one yet in 5 years of involved. Of course, this is why sometimes I can be a little bit in front, and then I'll in a sense I'll choke the event back a little bit because it's going so good. But you only need to have one crash which breaks two airbags, you know, the air fence, and that's a 20-minute delay, 15-minute while they change them. So it's about working and knowing the things and feeling it, in a sense. But yeah, it's all linked to being a professional show, and I think we've got a very professional show in the Grand Prix, and I'm proud of it.
FIM race director Phil Morris there talking about some of the things that go into making sure that the Grand Prix series runs like clockwork. Now, in episode 9 in September, I caught up with somebody who is a familiar face around speedway tracks and a familiar voice as well, because he does Centregreen announcing at some of the Ben Fund meetings, and also the voice of Newcastle and Redcar, and has been the voice of a few other tracks as well in the time. Roy Clark is the guy. Now, Roy, as a youngster, had dreams of becoming a speedway rider, and he was a speedway rider and rode for the Felton Flyers in the northeast, and has done a lot of work with Newcastle as well. I think he's done pretty much every job there is to do for the Newcastle Diamonds, including being team manager for a time briefly as well. But one of the other things that Roy does or has done is provided a place of accommodation for a number of riders, either British-based ones that just happened to be stuck in the northeast and needed a place to kip, or particularly the foreign stars that come over to Britain and find themselves leaving Denmark or Sweden or wherever behind and finding themselves in the middle of Newcastle. Roy has helped these riders integrate into northeast life, and here in the episode that I did with him, he talks about what it was like sharing his house with some well-known names of speedway.
Certainly with the Danes, were very similar, you know, because when, if you look back in history, when the Danes came over, they sort of landed in the northeast here. And some of our words that we use, like Geordie words, like Ganyem, it's like going home in Geordie. It's the same in Danish. Danish is for going home is Ganyem.
It's not, really?
It is. Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
So, you know, I've got to remember, you know, when Bjarne Pedersen first came over, Bjarne could hardly speak English. So Bjarne ended up with very much a Geordie accent, but after the 2 years, he left here. But, you know, great times, you know. The problem was with the house as well, it's not the same deco as what it is now, because I hadn't been moved in long, and the previous person who had my house was a young lady, and everything was pink. So this house got known as the Pink Palace for a lot of years. I think we've got very much the same sort of like mentality as well, you know, sort of like very friendly and things like this. So yeah. You know, we got on great. You know, When Kenneth Bier stopped at my house, you know, I wouldn't just have Kenneth for some weekends. You know, Lassa would be here as well, who's, you know, Lassa was only about 5 or 6 at the time when he came over to stop. I'd have his dad, Ivan, stop in here. You know, Kenny Larson's dad used to stop here quite a few times, and which was quite funny because Peter and I would have a little drink in the house, and there was one morning Kenny came downstairs and he came running back upstairs. He says, Roy, you've got to come down and see me dad. And came downstairs and his dad was lying on my settee and he was cuddling me Dyson vacuum cleaner. So we called him Dyson from then onwards.
It all happens at the Pink Palace.
It all happens at the Pink Palace, yeah. These are the stories I can't tell you. There's a lot I can't tell you.
Yeah, well, that's right. We want to protect the names of the innocent and the guilty.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, exciting. It must have been good, though, because for the riders finding somewhere to stay, I mean, I guess some of them around the country would find, you know, maybe a B&B to live at or whatever, or some kind of guest house. But to share a house with somebody who's involved in the sport and actually knows a little bit about, you know, speedway bikes, engines, track craft and all that kind of stuff must have been, you know, good for both of you, really, to be able to enjoy conversations like that.
Yeah, it was. I've also got a large collection of videos and DVDs of different tracks all over the country. So, you know, it was a common place for them to sit and watch a meeting before they'd go to an away track just to see what the track was like.
Ah.
So they weren't going in sort of like totally blind. Mind you, I think I regretted it when I showed a couple of the riders meetings from Exeter when they said, oh, that's big, that's bumpy. I says, wait till you see the safety fence, it's steel.
Yes. Yeah, old school safety fence. So you were a mechanic for some of these riders as well?
Yeah, I've spanned for a lot of riders. I didn't particularly spanner for Bjarne and Kenneth, even though they lived with me, because at the time I was mechanicing for Jesper Olsen, who was captain of Newcastle, another Dane, who's actually just recently moved back to Denmark. Him and his wife and his daughters have moved back to Denmark. Up till recently, he's been living at Bedlington, just up the road from here. And me and him have, you know, kept in touch. We were known as the old rockers by his wife, because we used to go out to gigs and have a blooming good time listening to music.
That's Roy Clark on Humans of Speedway from early this year, friend of the stars in the Northeast. From one Centregreen announcer to another, the voice behind the mic at Ipswich Speedway and has been for a long time, the man in the white suit, Kevin Long, joined us on Humans of Speedway early this year as well. At the time, he was gearing up to be the man in the middle for one of the only matches to actually have people in attendance, or at least that was supposed to be the way, with the British final that was due to be hosted there. Obviously, that didn't actually happen in the end, sadly. But we spoke to Kevin about how he came to be the voice of Ipswich. He's been doing it since that great season in 1998 that Ipswich had, and still doing it now. And how did that journey begin, though, and how do you become a Centregreen announcer? Here's Kevin Long.
When we sort of started going away on coaches and stuff like that, and I remember in the 97 season, we would go to all the meetings away. Our supporters club at Ipswich, very active in arranging away meetings, and we'd be away, and you know, we'd have such a laugh and a joke on the coaches, and you know, people were saying to me, oh, you know, you'd be good on the Centregreen. Why didn't you sort of get on the Centregreen? And I was like, well, I don't even know how to do it, you know, let alone, you know, how to even get the job. And we were away. I remember we were away watching the Witches at Bellevue. We were away on a weekend tour, and we actually were staying in the same hotel as the riders and the management. And when we all got back to the hotel, we're sort of having a drink in the bar, and we're sort of sitting around, and I was having a conversation with John Louis, obviously one of the promotional team at the time, and said, oh, you know, I could do that job. And he's like, well, he said, we're sort of committed to what we're doing now for 97. He said, but who knows what we might do next year. And that was all that was sort of mentioned about it. But it was towards the end of the 97 season, the Supporters Club invited me to present their end of season event. You know, where you get together, riders, rider awards are doled out, and everyone gets together for an end of season bash. Most clubs have them, and you know, it's highlighted at the end of the season. And so they invited me along to present the end of season awards in the evening. And so I put a lot of work into that, and a lot of research, and things. And unbeknownst to me, that the promotional team at the time of John Louis, his then wife Magda Louis, and Mike Weston used it as an audition. You know, it's a bit like X Factor for Speedway presenters. You know, they just didn't have the red buzzers in front of them. And I didn't realise that they were watching my performance, inverted commas, to such an extent that with an eye to inviting me to take the job for 98. And that's exactly what happened at the end of the evening. They said, yep, we like what you did and we'd like to invite you to be the Centre Greek presenter for the 1998 season. So, you know, that was amazing. And for a lifelong fan of Speedway, to actually get that job. And you've got to remember that John Erie, through the halcyon days of the sport, you know, the 60s, 70s and the 80s, I mean, John is regarded quite rightly as the best ever Centre Greek presenter. To sort of follow, I didn't follow John's footsteps immediately. There were a few in between. Rob Chandler, who is a local radio presenter, did it for a few seasons and had various other sort of people giving it a go. And with no broadcasting experience whatsoever, I've never worked in broadcasting, to sort of just be a fan off the terrace as given a microphone to do the job was, I wouldn't say it was a lifetime ambition, because I'd never really thought about doing it up until that sort of point. But, that was the first year, 98, and never looked back, really.
The voice of Ipswich, the man in the white suit, Kevin Long, on Humans of Speedway, as we look back on the best of the guests from 2020. And we spoke to an author, Helen Charlesworth, earlier this year. Now, Helen is a big fan of Speedway, first and foremost. She's a big Speedway historian and has got some great stories about the history of Speedway and some of the things that people got up to in the very, very early days that you can hear in the full episode that we did with Helen. But she's also an author as well and has written a couple of novels based around Speedway and based around a couple of riders you might recognise the names of. Jason Doyle. Did you know that he was a star of a Speedway-based novel? Neither did I till I spoke to Helen Charlesworth. Here she is talking about them.
I wrote books that I wanted to read. I read a lot of books on Speedway, but most of them, you know, they're either autobiographies, biographies, or facts and figures. And I really wanted to read a story. So why not write one yourself? And I also, because I like history, time travel, a whole lot of it, bag it up together. So these stories are about two teenage boys, Joel Armstrong and Will Roberts, and they both share a love of Speedway, but it's in different eras.
Uh-huh.
So in the first book, well, in both of them, Jason Doyle is Joel's all-time Speedway hero.
Okay.
But when he mentions this to Will, Will said he'd never heard of Jason. His favourite rider was Cordy Milne, and he first watched Speedway in 1936. So The story basically is Joel had gone to spend a week's summer holidays with his grandparents in Plymouth. And while his grandfather was doing some renovations, he came across a small glass lens, likely from an old-fashioned pair of wire-framed spectacles. And this lens becomes Joel's portal to the past. Sorry, his key to the portal to the past. His grand sends him off to deliver something to a friend in the next street. But that is also part of the portal. So every time he goes to this house, he goes through the portal. But of course, when he goes through, he's not meeting the lady he's supposed to. He goes through and he meets this boy, Will. It's Will's house in the 1940s. And at first he thinks this whole 1940s thing's a big hoax, but soon realises that when he sees the Luftwaffe bomb damage for himself and gets caught up in the Blitz, that this is real. And he begins to make regular visits to the past.
So he is visiting a friend, but they don't realise that he's going back in time to meet him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So prior to his visits to the past, Joel's always been a bit of a dreamer. He's always imagined himself with Jason Doyle, you know, the really good buddies. Yeah. They're travelling to away meetings. He's helping him out in the pits. And even when he's in war-torn Plymouth, he still daydreams about Jason a lot.
Okay. Is Jason Doyle aware that he features as a character in one of the only Speedway novels that certainly I know of?
Yes, he does.
He does.
Yes, Jason is aware. And also a few other riders play key roles in it.
Oh, okay. Who else is in it then?
Well, we've got some from the past. Yeah. George Pepper, Bluey Wilkinson. But I've had Adam Roynan and Tim Webster and Matty Bates all give me permission to have them play themselves in the book.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So they are characters and they're aware. They've got the books. They know that they're in there. Yeah, a few of the writers get minor starring roles, Ben Morley, Nicky Pedersen. It's not a book about name dropping. There's a specific reason that they're in there. They're in there for a reason, you know.
Yeah, I was just wondering if, you know, if they were aware that they're in it, and obviously they are. So and what was their reaction when you asked Adam Roynan and Jason Doyle and the like if they minded having their names in the book?
Well, Jason, I didn't tell him till just before I was going to publish it, but I said, if you don't want to be in, you know, then I'll change it. But I didn't hear back, so I'm presuming he's quite happy with it.
Okay.
And I know he's retweeted things, you know, that mention the book, so he's obviously happy with it.
Okay,
and
yeah.
He's a wonderful character in it. He is the hero. Okay. Adam, great. Yeah, Adam, Tim, Matty, brilliant. Yeah, I think they're quite honoured to be in it.
Yeah, it's an unusual thing to be part of, I suppose, isn't it, as well? And a bit of immortality for them in literature.
Definitely.
Okay, and these books are available now. Let's get on to the shameless plug section because if people want to read your Speedway novels, how do they get hold of them?
They're both available. I saw my other books on Amazon, and you can buy them as a paperback or as a download. And as a download, you don't have to have a Kindle. It can be to a mobile phone, a computer, whatever.
Okay, and if you just search out Helen Charlesworth on Amazon, all your books should probably come up, I would think, yeah?
Yeah, they will do, yeah.
Now, they say don't meet your heroes. And in episode 12, that was certainly a danger because I managed to arrange a chat with the 1992 world champion, Gary Havelock. Now, growing up, I was a Bradford fan. I used to go along most Saturdays to watch the Dukes. Obviously, Gary was the captain of Bradford in 1992. He became the world champion, as I mentioned. And, you know, he was a bit of a Speedway hero of mine at the time. And I was a little bit nervous about it, and I had to give him a ring beforehand to arrange it, and I rang him, and as soon as I spoke to him on the phone, I knew it was all going to be good, because you know what you hear is what you get with Javi. And it was a great episode, a great chat that we had, and check it out for yourself in full, episode 12. But here's Gary Havelock talking about becoming world champion in 1992 and the lead up to that and the actual meeting itself. Yeah, he doesn't hold back, but, you know, it was a brilliant achievement for Javi back in the days when the world final was a one-off, and there was no way that he was going to allow for that meeting to be rerun, shall we say. Here is Gary Havelock.
I saw many interviews and that people said, oh, first world final, you know, it'll be great, you know, the experience and all that, as you said, isn't it? Your first world final, you go there for experience. And I was like, fuck that, excuse me, like, fuck that. I ain't going for experience. I'm going to win. I'd beaten every single one of them riders over several times in the league. So in my mind, there was absolutely no reason whatsoever why I couldn't beat them again.
And there was no guarantee that you'd ever get to another world final. You don't know, that time?
Absolutely not, no. Like I say, I always dreamed of being world champion. I never dreamed of being the best speed rider ever. Don't know why. All I ever dreamed of was just of being the world champion. I think that probably hindered me for a few years after I won it, maybe, you know, psychologically. Sort of thinking, oh, what am I going to do now, like, you know?
You'd achieved the aim.
Yeah. This dream that had been, you know, the last 20 years of my life had been achieved at such a young age, but there you go.
And how was it then? I mean, because through the course of that evening, obviously this was back in the days when it was a one-off world final. Everybody starts on zero and stuff, and you know it could be won and lost in one heat or not.
Well, you know, depending on what happens, it was, because my first race I was against Per Jonsson, and I won it, and he came last.
Well, that certainly makes a difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. It
Simple
makes all
as
the
that.
Difference, and like you look back to the fact that Gate 4 was a massive advantage in them early heats there, and I'd been drawn at number 8, which is heat 2, gate 4. Thank you very much. You know, another day, another track, it could have been fucking graveyard, and I could have got filled in full of mud like Per did and end up running the last, but it is what it is. And then it started raining, and then it calmed down, thunder and lightning for about fucking half an hour, didn't it? And the track was flooded from the curb to about three quarters of the way out of the track was flooded. And I remember Mitch Shearer, a couple of the other riders were running around the pit saying, like, why don't we just get it cancelled? We'll just get it cancelled. We'll all come back tomorrow and start again. And I was like, fuck that.
Damn
I've
right.
I've already done the hardest bit. It's beating Perm, my first ride, as far as I was concerned. Like, my leg was hurting because a bike ran into me. But I was like, nah, let's go. Let's do it. We're racing.
Yeah, race on. And then that heat where it was all confirmed, I mean, you know, what were the emotions? Yeah, heat 17.
Yeah.
And like you were up against Mitch Shearer in that heat, weren't you, I think?
I don't know. I think I was, yeah.
Yeah.
I only need the first or second to be certain. I remember, just before going out for the race, I remember nearly being physically sick in my helmet. There was just so much emotions going on. My mechanic, as you see, my mechanic's hands shaking like a dog shitting razor blades, and my dad shouting something in one ear, and Neil Evans is shouting something in the other ear, and I'm thinking, I started spinning, I'm like, fuck, you know. And I was thinking, I wish you'd just open that gate. Finally, the gate opened, and I like pushed off, and then sort of gave myself a proverbial slap around the chops and said, sort yourself out. And I actually think that was the best start I've ever made. In my last ride in the world final, it was off gate two. It wasn't one of the favourable gates. But when they filmed it, they filmed it from the front. And normally from the front, you can't see when somebody's made a good start. You have to be sort of from the side. But you could even see it from the front. In fact, in this day and age, it was one of them that had probably pulled it back.
You reckon?
Yeah.
Well, at least they didn't. And no. You made it a great start. You were definitely first to the first bend. And then you were kind of like long tracking it, weren't you? Sort of down the back straights.
It was really
yeah.
funny, actually, because somebody put something on Facebook the other day. And because of all this talk about the way Smarzik rides his bike and that. And
yeah.
Like, oh, yeah, the way he hangs off the back. His arse is over the back wheel. He's trying to get as much traction as possible. And I was thinking, I used to do that. Nobody says that. And then, was it? So it might have even been Peter Walks or somebody like that put something on Facebook, apparently, over the weekend about he wasn't the first, having he was the first sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
A picture of me at Vatslav, long jacking it.
Yeah, you're sort of tucked in fast as you can go.
Yeah well, this is like, I've got to ride my bike fastest I've ever ridden it, ever.
Yeah.
So, every last ounce of straight line speed, whatever, I was going to try and nick it.
And you said about crossing the finish line and sort of not having sort of a massive amount of motion. You weren't punching the air and stuff like that.
I didn't know whether I'd have done a wheelie over the line and punched the air. I didn't do anything. I just rode over the line and then just put my head down on my handlebars and just like trundled round in a complete whirlwind of emotions and feelings and just insane, really insane.
And then you get to lift the trophy and all that, and when at what point does it really sink in? Because I imagine it's all like one of these occasions that sort of whizzes by, and it's only like the days afterwards where you think, "Whoa, bloody hell, what have I done?"
Well, I remember I got picked for the drug test as usual, and I remember it was that hot that I must have just sweated like every last bit of liquid out of my body, right? So straight afterwards, they told me about the drug test. So like, I'm drinking water, I'm drinking beer, I'm just trying to get liquid forced into me. Took me about over an hour to do it, didn't it? And then they were like, you got to come to the press conference.
Mm-hmm.
They've been waiting for you. So I've got took over like the press conference. So I've got my levers tied around my waist in a knot. Right, I've got a fag in one hand and a can of lager in the other hand. I walk into the press conference. There's about 150 people in this big room waiting for me. it was bizarre. It was understatement.
Excellent chat with Carrie Havelock. Listen for yourself. It was episode 12 and it was brilliant. I'm Ian Brannan. This is the Best of the Guests from 2020 on Humans of Speedway. And next was another world champion, but not a Speedway world champion. BDO, former world darts champion, Scott Mitchell joined us. Now, Scott, as well as being a prolific darts player, is also a prolific Pool Pirates fan. And so it was great to talk to him about, well, darts and Speedway. And how maybe if things had been a little bit different, there's a chance that he could have been a Speedway rider himself. He gave it a shot. It didn't quite work out, but he certainly had a motorbiking background. Here's Scott Mitchell.
Is it right that you, though, were you into your motorbikes in general and you were sort of into motocross as a youngster?
Yeah. Well, down south, we had this... a couple of friends of mine used to ride schoolboy motocross and... I would go with them as sort of like 8 or 9 or 10 and watch them riding motocross. So I was into motocross as well. And one of them actually was Mark Seabright. He was a friend of mine at 10 years old and now spanners for Doily. So it's quite strange. And he had a grass track career. And Jeff Wiltshire was Southern Centre champion, a grass tracker, and 10 or 12 years older than me. And they used to live in one of our farmhouses, his father did. So there was just everything around me, and Pete Munday, God rest his soul, lived about a mile away from our farm, and he used to come down and test his bikes back in the 60s on my granddad's farm. You know, there was nowhere to test Speedway bikes then, so he used to come down on a grass field and Pete used to test them there, you know. So, I suppose I had no choice. That Speedway was always going to be kind of the number one sport for me and probably always will be.
But with your background in motocross, obviously an interest in bikes in general, did you never consider giving Speedway a bash at all? I mean, could you have been the 2015 World Speedway Champion instead of darts?
No, if you've not seen me on the telly, I am a bit of a lump, really. So I'll be honest with you, I have the figure for a dart player, but not for a Speedway rider, to be totally honest. So I rode motocross from probably 18 till about 24. And then when we had the children, I was blatting up a straight on one, and there was Katie, my daughter, 3-4 months old, waving at daddy going up the straight flat out in fifth gear. And I thought, if I crash now, the wife's not earning, I'm the only one earning, we've got a house to the job, this is starting to take too many more risks than I need to be taking here. So that's and the fact that I'd sort of did some 500cc sort of amateur AMCA British Championship qualifiers and failed to qualify for the top 40 in the country. So I kind of knew that I wasn't good enough. I was daft enough. I just wasn't fast enough. So and I wasn't committed enough, probably. You know, I didn't want to go out running every night and all that sort of thing to make me as fit as a top guy. So, things happen for a reason. I just decided to knock it on the head. And I've been in every hospital in the south of England, you know, and you start going to hospital and they go, "Hi, Scott, at the emergency ward, when are you going in again?" it kind of, you know, and Dad was at home going, "What am I going to do with you? I've had a sort of like an ankle in cast and he's put me in the tractor and gave me and strapped my leg up because I had to have my leg elevated. So he strapped my leg up to the steering column in my tractor and I've gone off silaging for the day and he's given me a bottle and said, oh," I said, "I can't get out to go to the toilet." And he's given me a bottle and said, "Well, there you go. You'll be able to empty that out the window every couple of hours." And I thought, "Oh, thanks, Dad." So it was getting to the point where I was getting injured and it was affecting my work as well. So, it was time. But at 24 years old, I matured myself to say I'm not doing it anymore.
That's Scott Mitchell, who swapped motorbikes for darts and became world champion at that, and probably a lot safer, you'll have to say. The most recent guest on Humans of Speedway was a man who needs little introduction to Speedway fans in the UK and probably further afield as well. Not only was he a prolific rider, but three-time world champion at long track, and he's got his new book out as well called Tales from the Top Draw. And we had a peek inside that book to some of the tales that Kelvin has shared. And we looked particularly at one season, which was the 1985 season. You've got to remember, at this stage in Kelvin's career, he's not long been riding Speedway, only doing it a few years or so. And he found himself in a world final representing his country and really in at the deep end. And here he is talking about that massive season for him in 1985.
Yeah, well, I rode in three world finals in 85. I rode in the pairs, the team, and the individual final at Oddsall. And so that, again, that happened quite quickly. I sort of came away from Wimbledon. The second season at Wimbledon, I'd missed a large part of the season with a broken leg. So effectively, I'd done not very much racing, and suddenly I was riding in three world finals, riding with Kenny Carter in the pairs final, and then ended up being, I think, the only British rider to be in the world final at Oddsall. So it was quite, and joining Coventry at the same time. Just talking about it now, it was quite an incredible season.
Yeah, the 85 World Final, I think you were the only British show, because I remember, well, I don't remember, I was there, but I can't quite remember it. But having looked back on footage since, there were people holding up massive banners for Kelvin Tatum and stuff. I mean, rock star kind of treatment, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a bit overwhelming, to be honest, Ian. And in truth, it all happened rather quickly. I wasn't quite prepared for that. And I think I could have done with somebody like a Michael Lee, a Kenny Carter, one or two more established riders to have been in that world final.
Just to take the heat off the attention.
Yes. Yeah, I wasn't ready for that, because I was the only British rider in a British held staged world final. I mean, and I'd only been riding for 2.5 years. So it was difficult to come to terms with all that attention, to be perfectly honest.
Kelvin Tatum, it's his first world final. A heavy responsibility is on his shoulders as the only Englishman here at Bradford. His fast gating could be the key to his success.
Tatum in his first world final on the inside, the crowd on their feet and up to the first corner, and it looks like the Russian is gone, and so too is Tatum's made a terrific start. Tatum in front, second place is Mulder, third place is the Russian, at the back it's Castagna. Wow, what a start for Kelvin Tatum, almost overcomes the Fitz corner. But he's in front, 21-year-old, former public school boy. He's been getting in trim with his mum, Janet. She's a gymnastic instructor and has been doing aerobics on the lawn. Certainly has him at full stretch here. Is going into the last lap, 338 metres around Oddsall. And it is Tatum in front for England, then in second place, Mueller. In third place, it's the Russian, and the Italian way at the back. Quite a start for Kelvin Tatum. He's going to win his first ever world final race, and the crowd are on their feet. 3 points to Kelvin, 2 for Egon Müller, 1 point for the Russian.
And a crowd as well of, I'm not sure how many were there, but it must have been at least 40 or 50,000.
It was a terrific turnout. And yes, it was a nerve-wracking occasion. And one that I think that if I just had one or two other Brits with me that could have just taken a bit of attention off of me, I could have enjoyed a little bit more.
As you mentioned, though, not your only world final in 1985. There was the world pairs as well. And you look at the lineup for that, it was incredible. It was a who's who of Speedway at the time, really. Denmark with Erik Gundersen and Tommy Knudsen. England with yourself and Kenny Carter, as we just mentioned. United States, Bobby Schwartz, Sean Moran. New Zealand, Ivan Major and Mitch Shearer. I think that was Ivan Major's last appearance in a New Zealand jacket, at the very least. Sweden, Jan Andersson, Per Jonsson. Australia, Steve Regling and Phil Crump. And Poland, Gregor Jezowski and Andrzej Huszka.
Andrzej Huszka, yeah. Andrzej Huszka was quite a character, actually. He rode until he was 50. And he was a proper bloke, too. He was a bull of a bloke. He was like a Roman Matatek sort of character. And a smashing bloke, but he was around for a long time. But Poland were in a very different place in those days, of course.
Yeah.
The disparity between the 80s and the 2020 is stark, to say the least. It was my first world final. It was an incredible journey. We ended up with a silver medal, which, to be perfectly honest, I was chuffed to bits with.
And you did that alongside Kenny Carter, as we've mentioned. I mean, just focusing on him for just a second, his legend goes before him, and we all know about Kenny Carter, but quite a Marmite character in Speedway, if that's the right phrase. I mean, how did you get on with him? How did you find him? He's quite known for being a fairly fiery character on his day, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. But I didn't threaten him in a lot of ways. I think with a lot of his contemporaries, he'd sort of rubbed them up the wrong way. But that was primarily because he was so determined to do well. And I think that was I think that a lot of people misunderstood that as arrogance. It came across as that. So there's no question about that. He was somebody that was very different away from the track, which I was very fortunate to see. A lot of people don't know that. He was actually a really decent bloke, actually, away from the track. He did grow horns when you got there. And as long as you didn't sort of take him on when he was in that mood, he was fine, in actual fact. And I definitely benefited from his will to win. I embraced that rather than actually just sort of getting a little bit, you know, he might say something, or he might be a little bit brash about a certain subject or something, but generally he and I got on pretty well. And as I say, in that world final, he was great with me. You know, he was accommodating. There was no arguments over gate positions, for example. He didn't sort of stamp his authority saying, I'm having this gate all the time. We worked quite well. And I think that I had a good experience with Kenny Carter, where I know some people didn't, but I had a good one with Kenny Carter. Short, but it was decent. And it was a shame that he didn't win the world championship. He was good enough to. But he was almost trying to win it too much, if I criticise him. I think it was almost a sense of desperation to win it, and it didn't quite work out. An interesting character.
Kelvin Tatum speaking on Humans of Speedway in the most recent episode, which was episode 14. Don't forget to check out all of these in full if you haven't already. And if you haven't made it to the end of the various episodes, then each episode we get each person we've spoken to tell us about what their dream Speedway meeting would look like as well. So they're naming their all-time 1-7, their ideal track. Maybe they would change a rule as well. Really interesting, and sort of throws up all sorts of other conversations too. But that's at the final kind of 20 minutes or so of each episode. Check those out too. And as we're heading towards 2021, well, we hope for a much better new year. Of course we do. Health and happiness for your families. And, you know, hang in there, and hopefully things will be better very soon. And, of course, it'd be great to see some Speedway live and in person and get ourselves back into the stadiums in time for this summer. That's what we all hope for. And we've got some great episodes lined up for you heading into 2021. Keep following us on our social media channels. You can follow us on Twitter. We are at Speedway Humans. We're also on Instagram and Facebook as well. You get all the info as and when those are ready. And have a great new year. Thanks for following us. Thanks for listening through 2020. And we'll speak to you soon on Humans of Speedway.